Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today, we're all about remote learning as reporter stroke school teacher Terry Flanagan welcomes students of all ages into his online classroom for nature studies. We debunk the myriad of myths surrounding birds in wintertime. And Richard tells us about an interesting legal battle in the Big Apple.
Happy is an elephant in the Bronx Zoo in New York. There was a case in which an animal welfare organization decided that this animal was lonely and isolated on half a hectare in Bronx Zoo, and it should be moved to a sanctuary in Tennessee. They argued that elephants deserve habeas corpus status, that they should have the legal status of persons. So intelligent, so advanced are they.
So, a very busy show ahead of us today. Fascinating stuff about elephants coming up a little bit later on. And we will be giving you an update with my researcher, John Riley, about our RTE Eye on Nature wildlife photographic competition. Over 2,500 entries so far. And we only launched it last Monday. Isn't that incredible? Thank you very much indeed to all of our supporters for getting in touch with us and telling us how wonderful this competition idea is. We do appreciate it. rte.ie/Mooney. But let's get on with the programme. Let's say hello to our contributors. We'll start in County Clare with Aine Lana. Anything interesting in Clare this week, Aine?
Yes, there's loads of things interesting in Clare, but in the world of nature, I was looking at a field of curlew just yesterday. You were talking about curlew on the programme a couple of weeks ago.
We were.
And of course, the ones that I were looking at are winter migrants. They're probably saying curlew in Russian, perhaps, or in Scandinavian or something, because we get huge amounts of curlew coming in the winter time from further east, and this is a wet, mucky sort of a field. Wonderful for them to probe with their bills. They weren't exactly on the shore like I'm used to seeing them in Dublin. These were out in the field, poking their long bills into the soil. It was great to see them, I have to say.
And that's one of the points that came up in the documentary, Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland, who's in Greystones in County Wicklow. Niall, when we spoke about the curlew, the fact that so many of them are noticed at this time of year because they're winter migrants makes people believe that curlew are not on the decline, but not the case.
That's absolutely correct. Yes, a lot of bird watchers, I think, even have failed to recognise just how difficult the situation for that species is, because most of the curlews, the vast majority we see at this time of year, are migrants from further north in Europe. And the thing is, that's masked the decline in our own curlew population, our core breeding population here. No doubt some of those birds are mixed in with these flocks. We're not fully sure exactly where they go, but it's really hidden the fact that that the curlew is in trouble, because to a lot of people it still seems like a fairly common bird, but it really is declining as a breeding species quite massively.
Actually, I was having a discussion with somebody the other day, and we were talking about the Wildlife Photographer of the Year competition, not our competition, but the one that's held in Britain. It's been running for 59 years. They had 49,000 entries this year. They had 16 different categories, and they had opened it to people from all over the world. And the winning photograph was of a Siberian tigress hugging a Manchurian fir tree. And it took them 11 months to get this photograph, and they used hidden cameras. And somebody said to me, you know, is that not the kind of photograph we should be highlighting in your competition? And I said, there are plenty of species in Ireland that are on the verge of extinction. Why not highlight them? But actually, what we're trying to do with our competition is to celebrate nature. But if it just so happens that a photograph of a species like a curlew, which is declined by 97% in Ireland, then that's a good thing, correct, Noel?
Absolutely it is, yes. I completely agree. I think that obviously it's important that we acknowledge that things like the Siberian or the Amur tigers are having difficulty. Animals like snow leopards and giant pandas, of course, they're in trouble. But I think that those flagship species, they get a lot of international attention, and they hide the fact that here in Ireland we have our own very threatened nature, and nature that's really worth celebrating. I think sometimes we can see ourselves as being a poor relation when we see all the nature documentaries on television, where in fact we actually have stunning wildlife in this country that we should celebrate. I've had the great fortune of going to many schools schools over the years to talk about conservation, and I would always ask the children about endangered species. So I'd say, who can name an endangered species? And they'd say the polar bear or the giant panda or something like that. And they're not wrong, but it's a shame that they don't know more about the wildlife on their own doorstep that's endangered, and that they can actually take steps that will to help and to save those species. That's something that's often overlooked. So I think focusing on the beauty and the wonder of Ireland's own natural heritage in a photo competition like this is exactly the right thing to do.
Have you ever seen a Siberian tigress, Richard Collins, who is in Malahide in North County Dublin? Have you?
I have seen Bengal tigers, which are the ones next door. I've seen them in the wild. I have not seen the Siberian tiger, though. You mentioned curlews. Interesting thing about curlews, one of their peculiarities is, I read about this, that they hold winter feeding territories. In other words, a curlew likes to reserve a stretch of the salt marsh for its own use and keep other curlews out. Now, we have two curlews along the seafront near where I live, and they seem to be doing just that. And they sing sometimes, not very often, and possibly that singing is about defending their little stretch of luncheon territory.
That's what they're doing at the moment, of course. Keeping the territories to so they can feed and make sure they have enough energy to survive the winter is a very important part of the strategy for these birds. We're expecting some cold weather on the way relatively soon, so it's important that they put on as much weight as they can. So those feeding conditions are really, really important for them. I've been seeing that myself here on the Wicklow coast. I'm very fortunate where I live. Kilcool marshes are just within my 5 kilometer range. I like to go down there for my exercise walks along the beach, and I've been seeing the geese coming in there. So lots of Brent geese, which is our visitors that come in from Arctic Canada, mainly from Baffin Island. They travel across the Atlantic to come here to the coast, particularly the east coast of Ireland. There are also a couple of pink-footed geese, quite a rare visitor to Ireland, that seem to have tagged along with this flock. So it's been fun to spot them on the coast. And I'm also seeing a lot of non-avian activity too. There's quite a lot of rabbits down there at the moment hopping around. And of course, where there are rabbits, that brings in buzzards, and it also brings in foxes. And the foxes in my area here in Greystones have been very vocal over the last few nights. They're screaming their heads off because it's the mating season. So they've seen a lot of them wandering around in the streets too. They have one thing on their mind. So they're often a bit easier to find at this time of year than at others. But the main way to find them is from that screaming noise, and also the scent that they leave behind too. I think everywhere I'm walking now on my exercise, I'm getting this very sort of pungent odour of fox. It's a very distinctive smell at this time of the year, and it just shows how widespread a species that is.
I want to tell you about a scene I came across the other day, which I've posted on the website, rte.ie/Mooney. I was walking through Harwood Park and I noticed two magpies taking a bath together. Very interesting indeed. And it got me thinking about how birds manage in winter. Now, birds will wash themselves all year round, as we all know. You often see them having a little dip. But what about in wintertime? How do they survive? And I went online, and there are lots of myths about birds and wintertime. So let's have a look at some of these myths now, beginning with my question about why birds take a bath. Richard.
Well, Derek, I would say there's two great motivators, health and beauty. On the one hand, you have to keep yourself nice and clean, otherwise you will get... Now, remember, the bird has all kinds of creepy crawlies and what are called ectoparasites, skin parasites, crawling through its plumage. A bird isn't just a bird. It's a complete ecosystem. And it's like a forest. Forests in the way are fighting to keep the creatures from eating their seeds and so on and so forth. There's a constant war going on. And by washing, presumably, and preening's terribly important, you help to reduce the number of these parasites in you and the load they're demanding on you. The other thing is beauty. You want to look your best. And there's also an efficiency element. If your plumage is all tatty and all over the place, you won't be able to fly as well as you would if it's pristine and smooth. So there are lots of reasons why it's good to wash. We were the same. You go back in history, the Romans were great bathers. They had communal baths. And when Rome fell in the 5th century, the church took over and they had a very hostile attitude to bathing because they thought it was a source of sin, you see. So it's something like Michelangelo, for instance, never washed and he was covered in sores and he smelled and everyone commented on that. He was an extremely rich man and yet he had a terrible smell and he was always disheveled, you know. strange that that comes to mind. And the monks in, we went, you and I, Derek, to Westminster Abbey. The Benedictine monks there never washed, except for four occasions. There was 4 days in the year, spread out, Christmas, Easter, some other times, when they had to take a bath, because nature demanded it, in a sense. And in Versailles, for instance, nobody took a bath. You see these costume dramas on television with all these gorgeous ladies and fellas all dressed up. They never bathed. Can you imagine? Intimacy with such people would be a smelly business. And what did they do? They covered themselves in powders and things to deflect the smell. But the birds are the same. They keep themselves clean. Most creatures do. It's not just confined to birds.
Of course, this time of the year is beginning to be the mating season for the crows. So I presume the magpies that you saw, Derek, in Herbert Park having a bath were smartening up their feathers before they were going courting, because the crow families are the first of the birds to start making their nests. Probably the ravens are at it already because it's January and they're the ones to start off. Isn't that correct?
I think with the magpies, yes, that's a good example. And I think with birds like magpies that tend to form pair bonds that last more than one season, I think they there's a pressure on them to look their best as well. You know, there's a message there for all of us, I think, to try and keep themselves looking presentable. They also, in very social birds like magpies and members of the crow family, also with parrots, where they're interacting with others of their own kind all the time, they need to show that they're in good condition. Even outside the breeding season, they want to show that they're fit and they're healthy and they're able to cope with the elements, because otherwise they may be seen as less dominant or less deserving of the good roost site in the trees and so forth. And also, what's happening with the birds too, is that they need to make sure that their feathers are in perfect condition so that insulate them as effectively as possible, especially during the night when temperatures drop and they can't feed. So they spend their days frantically trying to find as much food as they can. And obviously at this time of year, the amount of daylight is shorter than it would be in the summer. So they would have to compress their feeding. This can take a toll on their feathers as well. They become rough around the edges. They're more likely to get dirt on them because they're so focused on feeding. And if they have dust and dirt and parasites between their feathers, this could actually hinder their insulating properties at night. So birds' feathers, really, it's like having a big duvet wrapped around them the whole time. They're able to keep warm air trapped between their skin and their feathers, and that keeps them very, very warm. And birds can survive almost ridiculously cold temperatures. The winter conditions that we have here in Ireland are no problem for most bird species, provided they have plenty of food to keep that internal furnace going. But if they have problems with their feathers, such as gaps or tears or abrasions, or perhaps pieces of dirt that are creating places where it can leach out, that reduces the effectiveness of that insulation, which means their survival chances in cold weather at night are lowered. So bathing becomes even more important. So there's many reasons why they would do it.
Yeah, and that leads on to one of the other myths I found online, that birds will freeze when the temperatures drop below 0 degrees Celsius.
Well, yes, that's certainly not the case. Many birds are well capable of surviving in temperatures well below that. I've had the fun of being in northern Russia in temperatures of minus 30, watching all the bullfinches and the redpolls and all of these very small birds coping just fine in such terrible temperatures, where I myself felt that it was barely survivable outside unless I had huge layers of clothes on. I had a scarf over my face. I could actually feel the water vapor and freezing inside my nostrils. It's a very strange experience. The birds are absolutely fine. They're finding lots of food. And of course, the ones that have the right sort of diet, they can adapt that kind of food, they stay put. The birds that can't find enough food, they migrate. And that's why birds migrate. It's people think it's because of cold weather. It's only where the cold weather means that their food supply can't be guaranteed, so they have to move elsewhere to find food. So taking a swallow, for example, swallows come to Europe in the summertime and they feed here on insects. They almost exclusively eat small flying insects, and in the nice warm summer there's plenty of those around. At this time of year, however, there are far, far fewer flying insects outside, and that's the only thing the swallows can eat, so they have no choice but to head down to southern Africa, where they get a second summer and they can have all the insects they want down there. But there are huge risks in doing that, because of course most swallows don't actually survive that migration. They're caught by predators, or they can't make it across the Sahara Desert, or just the strain of it's just too much. It's just the fittest of the fittest survive, whereas a bird like a blackbird, it can stay here here year round in Ireland because they can eat worms, but they can switch to eating then berries or seed or apples on bird tables. So they do much better. They have a more general diet, so they don't have to take the risk of migration away from Ireland. So it's really all about having enough food to make sure that that internal furnace can keep burning, to keep them warm enough under their feathers to make sure that they survive the cold nights.
And of course, birds and indeed mammals are the only warm-blooded creatures, which means that their furnace, as you put it, their metabolism inside, keeps their temperatures above ambient temperatures. It's only things that are cold-blooded whose temperatures are determined by the surrounding temperatures. I mean, when we go out in 2 degrees, our body doesn't go down from 38 degrees to 2 degrees. So why would people expect that birds would freeze? They're warm-blooded creatures.
Yes, indeed. They're very good at what they do. Otherwise, they wouldn't have survived this far on the evolutionary journey. And the whole question around the evolution of warm-bloodedness is really interesting because there are enormous costs to that. A warm-blooded creature needs to take on far more energy than a cold-blooded creature. You think of some snakes can go for months without eating, or perhaps even longer. You have some amphibians as well, which need not eat sometimes for years. And so it's absolutely incredible that they can survive. But it's because they have such a slow metabolic rate and they're not trying to maintain a body temperature that's above the ambient temperature around them. Of course, that means for these animals, when temperatures drop, they become very sluggish. They're less able to move around, which can make them quite vulnerable. So a lot of those animals would tend to be very well camouflaged, or they would hide away from the elements and from prying eyes. But it's the birds and us mammals that have a very different view of the world and a different way of surviving. And it seems that this warm-bloodedness in birds is something that started with dinosaurs. It seems that many dinosaurs were most likely warm-blooded. So they were warm-blooded reptiles. And it just goes to show how it's kind of proof again that the birds are directly descended from dinosaurs and are more closely related to dinosaurs than they are to any other living creatures today, any other living reptiles. So in a sense, birds are warm-blooded reptiles. And we humans and our mammalian ancestors also evolved this warm-blooded behavior. But it's not the norm in the natural world, that's for sure.
You mentioned dust, Niall, in connection with bathing. Now, there is another form of bathing, and it's dust bathing. So the birds, for some mysterious reason, go into the dirt, and they shake the dirt all over them and shake it into their plumage. And indeed, there's some theory that even after they've had a bath, that is a time when they like to dust bathe. Now, what possible explanation could there be for birds wanting to do that? Why clean up everything and then go and cover yourself in dust? Have you any ideas on that, Niall?
I do. I think it's, I suppose it depends on the quality of the dust. When they're doing that, they tend to be bathing in very, very dry material. So they're not going into mud, like not wallowing in mud like a pig might do. They're going into, if it doesn't sound too much of a contradiction, they go into clean dust. And it fulfills a similar purpose to sandblasting. It removes particles, removes parasites particularly, because parasites are even worse than dirt because they're sucking the blood of the creature. They're making it feel poorly. They're reducing its survival chances and stealing its energy. So removing those is very important. And it also seems to be something that has evolved in some bird species and that would tend to live in arid regions. So if you look at a bird like a house sparrow, that's a bird that I always think of as dust bathing quite a lot. They do it a great deal. That's a species that's very much associated now with towns and also with agricultural areas. But that's a bird that seems to have expanded with humans as we traveled across Europe and was able to take advantage of early farming and live alongside us. It seems to be a species, however, that evolved, first of all, in very arid regions, perhaps in the Middle East or in the desert regions of Northern Africa, and where water would be harder to come by. And so this dust bathing behavior seems to have evolved there to, I suppose, replace water. The dust is flushing the dirt and the parasites out of the bird's feathers. And that behavior, it being an evolutionary thing that's been there for a long time, the birds have no control over it. That's something that they still seek out. And of course, those particles of dust are very, very small. So they're not really having too much of an effect on the insulation properties of those feathers. So even if there's some slight disadvantages there, they're more than offset by the fact that they're removing parasites. And in some ways, dust can do that in a way that water can't, because for some parasites might have no problem getting a little bit wet, but the abrasive action of the sand as the birds fluff their feathers, a little bit like rubbing sandpaper on when you're removing paint or something, that's a similar sort of effect. So that seems to be the reason why they do it.
One last myth that I came across online. I mean, there are hundreds of myths about birds in winter, but just you guys speak so eloquently, it's very hard to ask questions. Anyway, here we go. Birds' feet will stick to metal bird feeders and suet cages on cold days. What do you think about that, Aina?
That's complete rubbish. Sure, that rate of going, it'd be a way of catching birds and you wouldn't need bird lime or anything else. Of course they don't, because they don't have, they're different feet to us. They don't have big soft feet with blood right down to the end. We might stick to the ice cubes when you're trying to take them out of the fridge, but we've different fingers entirely to birds' feet. I mean, who are these people that ask these stupid questions? Have they ever looked at a bird, for goodness sake?
Richard.
Well, I'm reminded of the Atlantic convoys in the Second World War up to Murmansk. And one of the things the sailors were warned not to do is put their hands onto the metal bars surrounding the ship, because in no time your hand would freeze onto the bar. The sweat, the perspiration would freeze. Now, in the case of a bird, that wouldn't happen, because a bird's feet are already cold. The artery going down passes down the leg, passes the vein coming back up, and the heat from the artery going down is transferred to the vein going back up and keeps the foot cool, because the foot is a source of heat loss. So there wouldn't be any perspiring anyway. Birds don't perspire. So there would be no moisture there to freeze up the bird, and there wouldn't be enough heat in the foot to thaw the moisture on whatever surface they landed sufficient for it to refreeze and keep them there. I think it very unlikely that a bird would ever freeze like that.
I think that's right, Richard. I think that that the fact that we humans are quite inefficient in our use of water is the key here. We have water leaking out of our skin all the time, and it's in small amounts. We don't normally notice it unless we're sweating profusely, but it's that freezes. And birds, as you say, don't sweat, so that's not going to be a problem for them. And it's the case with many mammals as well. They're covered in thick layer of fur that stops any sweat or any other moisture from reaching the outside atmosphere and freezing onto things. So it's a kind of a problem that just we humans have, because we didn't really evolve to live in very cold weather the way that the birds and many other mammals did.
All right, let's move on now. Time to give you an update on the RTE Ion Nature Wildlife Photography Competition. Here it comes.
Look deep into nature, said Albert Einstein, and you will understand everything better. And where better to celebrate our natural world than in the art of nature photography? Calling all budding photographers and nature lovers alike. Join us for the first Ion Nature Wildlife Photography Competition. To enter, see rte.ie/eyeonnature. For updates, watch The Today Show on RTE One and tune in to Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio One. Eye on Nature, presented by RTE with the National Botanic Gardens Dublin and the Office of Public Works. RTE Eye on Nature. See the world.
Yes, indeed. Our Eye on Nature competition is a new partnership with RTE and the Office of Public Works at the National Botanic Gardens, with TV, radio and digital programme partners. The Today Show on RTE One Television, Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio One, and www.rte.ie. I mentioned earlier that we've already received in excess of 2,500 photographs, individual pictures taken by individuals, the Irish listening and viewing public, on the island of Ireland, around our coastal waters and on our offshore islands. But just what are those pictures like? To give us a little idea of what we're getting in, we have our researcher John Bellariety to tell me more. John.
Yes, Derek, thousands of entries in already in what makes for a great study and contemporary snapshot of the wild things of Ireland. Indeed, all living things, great and small, are represented, from our largest land mammals, the majestic red deer, to the macro photography of the tiniest brightly coloured ladybirds perched on contrasting foliage.
Oh, beautiful.
There are migrating geese, slumbering foxes, whales a-blowing, and a galaxy of iridescent butterflies, and truckloads more to enjoy on the Mooney Goes Wild Facebook and Twitter feeds. So from the earliest entries, from the first couple of hours, we had hundreds of entries in, and they're the ones that we've got through so far, Derek. And some of the ones that struck me were these. For example, A Dolphin by Judy O'Toole. What struck me is the muted and somewhat mystical colour scheme of greys and blues, and sky reflected on the shimmering water surface together make up a fantastic composition by Judy O'Toole.
Very nice. Well done, Judy. Yeah, go on.
Mark Doyle sent in a quite mesmerising photo of Brent geese taking off on a green in a housing estate. It may not instantly sound like the most graphic scene, but what makes it for me is the repetition of the takeoff pattern of the 50 or so geese in the frame. The shallow depth of field showing those in the foreground in sharp focus, while those further from the camera blurring to obscurity.
John, I better say at this stage that you're not a judge. You're just doing the pre-selection.
No, absolutely. Exactly that, Derek. So what I'm simply doing is sifting through, reducing that field of thousands of entries down to a much shorter long list. So the next image, I suppose, would fall under the category of unlikely cute subject matter. Holly Grogan sent in three brown rats in almost symmetrically identical poses, enjoying a drink at what looks like a stagnant puddle. Doesn't sound very pretty, Derek, but it's beautifully framed and technically an excellent photograph.
I'm looking at it, and you know what? I didn't realise they were rats at first, but they are beautiful, and it's a wonderful picture. Well done, Holly.
The next is one that you particularly enjoyed, Derek. It's a solitary coal tit perched at the end of a branch. Again, technically superb, great earthy greens and browns of the branch and bird contrasting beautifully with the snow on the tree and the snow falling around the bird who gazes defiantly into the wintry
scene. And that's very close to what I described myself when I saw the robin outside my garden last Thursday week when it was snowing, because Dahi O'Shea had asked me on the Today Show last Monday, well, what would I try and take a picture of? And I said, if I had a good camera and I was a good photographer, that's what I would try and capture. The simple images, the ones we see every day but we kind of just take for granted, they can sometimes be the beautiful ones. But can I stress, I'm not a judge either. So it doesn't matter what I want, it's down to the judges, but a lovely picture it is too.
And finally, Derek, possibly the most dramatic for me personally is a crab spider perfectly concealed within a daisy, camouflaged by its snug fit, an identical shade of canary yellow to the flower. It is eye to eye, or perhaps more accurately, compound eyes to compound eyes with an unsuspecting fly, identified by our own Aidan Alauna as a drone fly. You expect that this photo is the last frame where the fly was seen alive.
Oh, cruel, 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 but beautiful nonetheless. That is nature. That's what it's all about, the survival of the fittest. John, thank you very much indeed. All the details are available on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. If you think you have a photograph that has what it takes to be the winner of the inaugural RTE Eye on Nature Wildlife Photography Competition.
Look deep into nature, said Albert Einstein, and you will understand everything better. And where better to celebrate our natural world than in the art of nature photography? Calling all budding photographers and nature lovers alike. Join us for the first Eye on Nature Wildlife Photography Competition. To enter, see rte.ie/eyeonnature. For updates, watch The Today Show on RTE One and tune in to Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio One. Eye on Nature, presented by RTE with the National Botanic Gardens Dublin and the Office of Public Works. RTE Eye on Nature. See the world.
Basic rules are you got to be over 18 and we'll only accept one picture per person, just the one. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney. Now, while we haven't been enjoying much exotic travel recently, many of us are looking forward to heading off again soon, maybe even this year. And ecotourism, which helps with wildlife conservation by supporting communities through sustainable travel, has become an increasingly popular option. Have a listen to what Michelle Chang of internationaltravelers.com said about her trip to the Kindred Spirit Elephant Sanctuary in Thailand.
In the mountains of northern Thailand, hill tribe villages have long been caretakers of elephants. One such community is bringing elephants who have been exploited by the tourism industry back home. Kindred Spirit Elephant Sanctuary is more than just a chance to get up close and personal with elephants. They offer an immersive, overnight homestay experience in a remote hill tribe village. During our recent stay in Thailand, we had the opportunity to try this unique experience for ourselves.
And the Kindred Spirit Elephant Sanctuary was set up by Irish woman Kerry McRae from County Tyrone. In 2013, after graduating with a degree in zoology from Queen's University Belfast, Kerry headed east to work with elephants. She joins us now from a very remote village in northern Thailand. Hello, Kerry. Can you begin by painting a picture of where exactly you are?
Hi, everyone. So I am here in northern Thailand, about 5 hours drive away from Chiang Mai, which is the closest city to the village that I live in. We are very rural up here, and I actually live in a hill tribe village. The village is part of the Karen Hill Tribe, who are very much the elephant people of Thailand and also very keen weavers as well. So things are, yeah, very basic, but everyone here is very happy and very content.
Very different to Tyrone, I imagine.
Yes, very, very different indeed. So quite often we don't have running water here. We have electricity, but if any wires are down in the greater area, the electricity can go off for a couple of hours and once even for a couple of days. There's just animals everywhere. So we have dogs and cats and buffaloes and cows and elephants, of course, and everything just in and around the village. Chickens and pigs as well, just running around. It's very different, but it's a place that very quickly grows on you.
Now, you could have gone to study elephants or work with elephants anywhere. Why Thailand?
So I kind of feel like Thailand chose me. So after I graduated from zoology at Queen's in Belfast, I somehow managed to get a job working with elephants in Thailand. So I came out and started to work with the elephants here in another Karen village, which is where I met my husband Sombat. And from there, I worked with together with that village for about 2 years before me and Samba decided we would set up our own project.
So do you speak the language?
I speak the local Karen language, which is much easier than the nationwide Thai language, but I am learning the Thai language as well. It's definitely something that's very important if you live here to speak some of the local dialect.
Well, now, Aina and Richard can't wait to ask you questions about elephants. Richard.
Hello, Kerry. I am very eager to talk to you about these wonderful animals, the elephants. Now, you are running a sanctuary for elephants, a kind of a refuge, I gather, for elephants. What exactly are you at?
So basically, myself and my Thai husband, we run an elephant foundation and sanctuary together. And our main aim is to bring elephants home to live life as naturally as possible in the forest.
Well, now in Thailand, I gather, there is a certain amount of controversy surrounding elephants. Most elephants work. They get into trouble when they escape, or wild elephants get into trouble trampling crops and eating up farmers' entire livelihoods in a matter of hours. So you're in a kind of conflict situation, are you?
So the elephant situation here is a very complicated one. There is basically two different situations. There's the situation of the wild elephants, and there's the situation of the captive elephant population. So what we work with is the captive elephant population. And as you mentioned, a lot of them before COVID hit were working in elephant camps. So basically working to entertain tourists in different ways, like some elephant camps did riding, some did bathing, some did feeding, etc. So all of these elephant camps, as I mentioned, it is a very complex situation, one that's very difficult to sum up, but each one is very different from the next. Each one has their own values and their own priorities. But in quite a few of these camps, elephant welfare is unfortunately not always a top priority, and kind of just being run as a business. So in many places, elephants are being worked a lot and their needs aren't always being met. So we're basically trying to create a model that works away from that and bring elephants home to live life in the forest, where we bring out visitors and volunteers to come and see the elephants in their natural habitat, and we hope that this type of model will spread to other areas as well.
Now, suppose I was an elephant in a camp and I was getting on in years and I was no longer that useful to the managers of the camp. Would I be shot or would they ring you up and say, will you take this elephant off our hands? And if they did, what would my experience be going to your establishment?
So, elephants in Thailand. Thailand is a Buddhist country and they don't believe in euthanization, so you would never be shot, thankfully, which is a good thing. So if there was a very old elephant, quite often in the camps they will just take care of them until an old age, and if there comes to a point where they can't take care of them, if they are privately owned elephants, then the owner will look for a place, a retirement place, where the elephant can go. And if, of course, we were to be contacted about an elephant, we would do everything that we could to be able to take care and provide for that elephant. So the elephants that are in our foundation, in our sanctuary, basically roam all day and they go wherever they want to go. They each have an elephant caretaker. We call them a mahout, who usually has grown up together with this elephant. So the elephant knows them. They know their elephant. They have a very good mutual respect and understanding of each other. They have a very good bond with each other. And that mahout can then take the best care of this elephant and make sure that the elephant is roaming as safe as possible and as much as possible in their natural habitat. So in our sanctuary, the elephants are basically just elephants. They get to choose what they want to do, when they want to do it, and pretty much where they want to go.
Now, when I arrive at the sanctuary, I've left my mahout behind back at the camp where I work. I don't have a mahout anymore. I've been on elephants in India with a mahout. A mahout would run the elephant and I would be with him going out looking for wild creatures such as tigers and things like that. It seemed to me almost as though the mahout and the elephant were married. They were like a married couple. There was this extraordinary relationship between them. And I wondered what would happen if I sat up and started to drive the elephant, or if a stranger started to drive the elephant. The young elephant arriving in your foundation has no mahout. Are you a kind of surrogate mahout, an adopted mahout or something like that?
So if that were the case and there was an elephant that the caretaker or the mahout wasn't able to come or didn't come with an elephant, we would basically find another mahout to help take care of the elephant. We work very closely with our local community here, and the community that we work with and that we live with and that we're fully immersed with, they are an elephant community, meaning they have all grown up with elephants that have been passed down through their generations, through their families. They pretty much all have elephants. They all know elephants. They all know how to work with elephants. And so if we had an elephant that needed a mahout, we could very easily hire one of the local mahouts that are in the community here. And they would have to spend a lot of time getting to know the elephant. The elephant would need to get to know them until they create a bond. Quite often I say with our elephants that the elephant chooses the mahout rather than the mahout chooses the elephant. Because if the elephant isn't happy with his mahout, he will let the mahout know, and then we just have to find another mahout, because if the elephant doesn't like the mahout has a very difficult job, and we need to find a mahout that has a good bond and a good respect with the elephant.
Is he paid for that? And how much time does that take up? Is it a full-time job or something he might do a couple of times a week?
So our mahouts are all paid. They all spend every day with their elephants. It is very much a full-time job. There's just no way that taking care of such an intelligent animal can ever be a part-time job, and they need to always make sure that the elephant is safe and in a safe area. So yeah, very much a full-time job and a very difficult job as well. A lot of mahouts do not get the respect that they deserve. So there's so many mahouts that are out there, and a lot of people will, you know, they'll give them a bad name because they're the ones that are tasked with taking care of these elephants, and a lot of people will take that the wrong way and see that the wrong way. So the mahout's job is a very difficult one, often a dangerous one as well, because elephants are wild animals. and they need more respect, basically, in the world and in the industry.
Now, Aristotle said that the elephant is superior to all other animals in wit and mind. Now, elephants communicate with each other physically and vocally. They are highly social species. It seems to an outsider that they have a kind of language or a system of communication. Presumably, you now understand elephant speak, do you?
So I wish I could say that I 100% understand elephant communication, but unfortunately it all comes down to the science of it all. And with Asian elephants, there's just not a lot of science that's been involved with their species. A lot of the science behind elephants comes from African elephants, because the elephants in Africa are just a lot more funded, so they get a lot more research that's put into them. Whereas the elephant species, they're just, in comparison, there's just not a lot that goes on in regards to their communication and in regards to their welfare. And that's actually one of the things that we're working on, is improving the research that's carried out on Asian elephants. Because with our elephants, we kind of have the perfect situation here, where our elephants are essentially semi-wild or semi-captive, whatever way you want to term it. And we're able to go out and we're able to see them in the forest and in their natural habitat, and they're able to decide to do what they want to do. And that gives such a good opportunity to record their natural behaviors, so that we can then interpret them, write up papers, get it published, and use that information to further the knowledge of Asian elephants, and on top of that, increase their welfare as well. And so we've actually published a paper on elephant foraging. So you guys, I can send anyone through a link if anyone wants to get in touch and read that paper. It is something that's very interesting. But in regards to elephant communication, we really wish that we could sit down and have an actual conversation with our elephants, so that we're making sure that we're fulfilling all of their needs, all of their welfare, all of their understandings. But we definitely do our best by reading their behaviour and watching how they interact with each other, how they interact with their mahouts, and how they interact with people coming to observe them, etc. And yeah, we're still learning, and we're just working with what we have.
Kerry Aine here. I'm very interested in all you have been saying about the elephants, but it seems to me that there seems to be a huge difference between wild elephants and the elephants in your sanctuary. Elephants, as far as I used to know at any rate, are in herds. They're a matriarchal society. There's a herd of elephants, a family of elephants. In your sanctuary, you have individual elephants. There's no family structure there. How does that work out?
So in our sanctuary, we actually do have family structures. So we have 5 elephants. We have a grandmother, we have her daughter, we have the 2 nephews, and then we have 1 unrelated elephant who thankfully gets along very well with the rest of the herd. And from that, we've actually seen a lot of very similar behaviours to wild elephants. And from the data we've collected, we have been able to conclude many times that our elephants' behaviour is a lot more similar to those of wild elephants than they are to those of fully captive elephants, which was very interesting for us to be able to observe that. So with the grandmother, she seems to be very similar to a matriarch of a herd. The other elephants, they will basically follow her around, and she'll lead them to places with the best water and the best food. And the younger elephants are always looking to the older elephants and kind of learning the behaviours from each other. And this is everything we've gathered from kind of our scientific research that we collect very often on a normal basis before COVID hit, unfortunately. And yeah, it's been very interesting to be able to observe that and to be able to interpret that.
Are wild elephants in Thailand under pressure? Surely they need a lot of habitat, and you're saying their natural habitat is woodland, is rainforest essentially. So is there a conflict there? Are the rainforests being removed and the elephants, the wild elephants, under pressure for habitat?
Yes, completely. So there is not enough forest left in Thailand for even just the wild population of Thailand. There are many people out there that will say that all elephants should just be released into the forest, especially the captive population. But the wild population is already struggling to pretty much survive and thrive in their natural habitat because of the huge amounts of deforestation that has happened in Thailand in the past and is still happening today. So, many wild elephants that live inside national parks, because that's the main area where the wild elephants live right now, is inside different national parks. Quite often during the nighttime, they will come out and destroy people's crops, destroy people's fields, and it creates very much a conflict. And there's many people that's trying to help mitigate this conflict, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Kerry, I'd like to ask you your views on Happy, an elephant in the Bronx Zoo in New York. There was a case in which an animal welfare organization decided that this animal was lonely and isolated on half a hectare in Bronx Zoo, and it should be moved to a sanctuary in Tennessee. They argued that elephants deserve habeas corpus status, that they should have the legal status of persons. So intelligent, so advanced are they. What is your comment on that?
So I definitely agree to an extent that elephants should very much in terms of law be placed at a higher point, because they are a very intelligent species. Although they're not able to communicate us what their actual needs are, they are very intelligent, and that should definitely be taken into account when it comes to the laws of the land and things like that. With Happy, I'm not 100% sure of their case, but if they are a lone elephant, elephants are very social animals. They do need to have, the other kind of elephant friends around to ensure that their welfare is being met. And yeah, if that's not the case, then the elephant should definitely have the opportunity to be taken to a place where it does have that opportunity.
Well, Kerry, it was fascinating speaking with you today. Thank you very much indeed.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
And more details about Kindred Spirit can be found on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Now, as COVID restrictions continue to keep us close to home, it would be very easy to feel that life has come to something of a standstill, as we're all pretty much confined to barracks. But as we know, the world does keep a turning, and the circle of life continues in all its glory.
In the
And despite the ravages of the virus, as sure as night follows day, winter will turn to spring, and there's so much in the natural world for us to look forward to. That said, children in particular are affected by the closure of schools, not to mention their poor, long-suffering parents, who are once again having to play the role of teacher in the task of homeschooling. So here in Mooney Goes Wild, we want to play our part in helping people of all ages. And to that end, we're introducing a new feature on our website, which is called Nature Studies with Terry Flanagan. Why Terry Flanagan? We'll let him tell you. Terry.
Well, I suppose I'm the reporter on the Mooney Goes Wild programme for 20-odd years, but I've also been a teacher for 40-odd years. Who better to talk about school than a teacher with experience like I have? And that's why we decided to put something up on the website. So what we're actually doing is we're putting up a piece on the website every week on various plants and animals for people to read, some interesting pieces of information about their science, their biology, their folklore, and then some questions at the end of it if people want to take them. They're not just for kids in school, they're there for adults as well. But let's not forget, for the school children, particularly for secondary school children, they have to study in biology ecology every year. And the ecology deals with the study of a habitat and the plants and animals in a habitat. So they're definitely going to be of importance, and they're also going to be of use to those students who will be sitting both the Junior Cert and the Leaving Cert exams this year.
And Terry, when it comes to the Leaving Cert, you've got the inside track, because for as long as I've known you, you've been correcting exam papers.
Yes, for 30 plus years, I have corrected the Leaving Cert Honours Biology. Yeah, so I'm a long time at it, Derek, and can tell you, yeah, it's a long time.
Now, give me an idea of what kind of tidbits of information you've put on the website, please.
OK, well, to start with, we've put up five plants and animals. We've put up the heron, the ash tree, the barn owl, the frog and the dandelion. That's just going up this week. Every week from now on, we're going to put up two new species with more and more information. So it will build up into quite a lot of information for students to glean through and maybe take some pieces of information from this that they could use in their exams. So starting off this week, I've picked things I feel are close to hand, number one, because we can only move within 5 kilometres of where we are. And secondly, something that's relative to this time of the year. So we're moving into late winter or early spring. So the first animal I have up that will be very, very prominent in the next month or so, and even now we're having reports of them being around, is the frog. Now, the frog, his name is Rana temporaria. That's his Latin name. Linnaeus gave him that name. Linnaeus, or Carl Linnaeus, was a famous taxonomist. And he devised this, what's referred to as this binomial system, whereby you would have two words for the name. So in Latin, he called the frog Rana temporaria, which meant temporary frog. And the reason for that is because we only ever see the frog at certain times of the year. And Linnaeus didn't understand where the frog went to, thought he disappeared. But in fact, we now know that the frog hibernated. So that's why you only see the frog in the summertime. And this time of the year, you'll see that the frogs will be coming out of hibernation and they'll be mating. And that's an incredible sight when you watch those frogs mating. The male frogs have this swelling on front foot. It's called a nuptial pad when he grabs the female. And the fertilization is somewhat unusual because it's not internal but external. So what happens is she releases the eggs from her body. And as the eggs are passing into the water in the pond, he adds a sperm to it. And they become fertilized, or this jelly-like material swells up. We call it frog spawn. So frogs are something to be looking out for. Again, if you're near a river or if you're near the canal or somewhere where there's very slow-moving water or little ponds or something like that. And of course, if you do see frogs and if you do see frog spawn, do get on to the Hop to It Frog Survey from the Irish Peatland Conservation Council. They're all the time, I don't know how many years, it must be 20 years or more, recording frogs around the country, not just at this time of the year, but at all times of the year. And one thing that has come out of that survey is that the gardens are becoming very important habitats for frogs. So it's not just you're going to find them in a canal or a river or in a swamp like that. You'll also find them in the bottom of the garden. So that's the kind of information we'll be giving out every week on the website. And I hope as many people as possible can log on to Nature Studies with me, Terry Flanagan.
rte.ie/Mooney, that's where you'll find it. Thank you very much indeed, Terry Flanagan. Thanks also to Aina Nilana, to Richard Collins, to Niall Hatch, to all of our contributors, my researcher John Riley, our broadcast coordinator Jarlath Holland, and producer Anna Leddy. Until next week, goodbye.
Look deep into nature, said Albert Einstein, and you will understand everything better. And where better to celebrate our natural world than in the art of nature photography? Calling all budding photographers and nature lovers alike. Join us for the first Eye on Nature wildlife photography competition. To enter, see rte.ie/eyeonnature. For updates, watch The Today Show on RTE One and tune in to Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio One. Eye on Nature, presented by RTE with the National Botanic Gardens Dublin and the Office of Public Works. RTE Eye on Nature. See the world.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.